pipes and systems and do inspections. They also, the commitment to the NRC was we would wholeheartedly embrace this initiative, and we are inspected to it because it's in our procedure.
Oh, okay.
So they don't, this is not a regulation, but it's in our procedures, which becomes part of regulation.
Yeah, gotcha.
Right?
Thank you.
That pointer. Okay, Oconee is near Clemson, South Carolina. This is a drawing of the site. I'll try to orient you a little bit. These are Unit 1, 2, and 3. If you have ever been to Oconee, you would come in this entry road, the Kiwi River's on this side to the east of the plant. These are the switch yards, electrical switch yards associated with the plant. So we had, during the refueling outage back in May at Oconee, they were transferring water from this pond, we call it chemical treatment pond 1, and the small one is 2. They're really not chemical treatment ponds. That's kind of an old misnomer for it. What happens is the water from the secondary side of the plant, from the turbine building sumps and other areas, are moved up there for that water to be pH adjusted and have some other adjustments done prior to being released into the environment. So water was being transferred from this pond through, it's basically a yard drain type system because it does collect storm water, but it's a line system that runs down behind the plant, down this way, and it'll go into this pond, chemical treatment pond 3. Their samples are done, and we do composite samples off of that and do the final analysis for that to account for any radioactivity that may be in that water. Typically, the only thing we ever see is tritium, and it's very low levels because it's incidental water from the secondary side of the plant. But it does have tritium in it. So that's the basic layout. This, the line you see here, the double line, is a security boundary, and that plays into this scenario. So I'm going to blow up now this corner. So here's Unit 1, 2, and 3 again. This is a, I don't know what that is. This is a large office building here. I must have some.
You didn't touch it.
I didn't touch it. I guess it's got a something on there making it change by itself. So we'll see if we can make it act right. No. I don't know how to fix it. Anyway, what we saw in this little corner here where the pipe runs from this pond into that yard drain system was a puddle of water. And I'm going to show that pipe in a minute. It wants to know, show you. And we actually saw water down here on the ground.
That's what he's doing.
That's what I'm doing. This slide probably has an automatic advance on it that we didn't realize. But we're going to get off that slide. Anyway, so we saw, sorry about that. So the pipe comes in here, and we saw the leak at this point. Now you can change. So here's, this pipe is not what leaked. We saw the water coming up from, Steve didn't do that when we made this thing.
Yeah.
The water was coming up from the ground here. And now here's the same pipe that ran across the asphalt and into, what's going on with that? Into this storm drain here. So the reason, and I'm going to let it stay there maybe.
Oops.
So the reason we made the report, we saw the water coming up from the ground around that pipe, and that is gravel and soil there, so it does have the potential to reach the groundwater for any leak there. So what had really had happened, now, and I'll tell you the end of the story first, then we'll go through this, but what had really happened is we had a security modification done when that boundary, the security boundary, were put in, and they drilled a hole in the side of basically a manhole and ran some wires through it, and they didn't grout the hole around the wires. So when the transfer from that pond was taking place, it filled up that manhole, it ran out through the hole, it wasn't grouted, went into the ground, and that's where the water came from. So on the afternoon of May 6th, someone identified the water running across the asphalt there, and the chemistry folks that operate the ponds and the operations were notified, investigation started, the weepage from around the pipe was identified. We really didn't know, and still don't know, how much water would have leaked there, because it had been going on with that release for several hours. But we knew that it was at least greater than 100 gallons. We measured the tritium activity. It was about 3,000 picocuries per liter. That's just about our detection limit for tritium at the site. So it's just barely detectable, but it is detectable. So actions were taken to prevent additional transfers from that pond, basically stop the discharge. We made our plans and communicated to our local stakeholders and to the state. Emphasize that this water has not migrated off-site, cannot migrate off-site based on where it is and the structures in between it and the river that it would have to get to. The hole was identified in that manhole and repaired. It was a fairly simple repair to do that.
I have a couple questions.
Please.
So this was a leak, but not a line break. Is that right?
Right. It was a leak,
but not a line break.
That is correct.
Okay. You got a repair plan, but how are you going to keep people from drilling holes where they shouldn't drill holes?
That is a very difficult thing to accomplish, because that's part of the 0707 initiative. Is dealing with work practices and awareness of workers and folks doing things like drilling that hole. Is how do we communicate and how do we maintain training so our workforce identify things like that mm-hmm. when they're happening. So that's probably the hardest thing we've got to deal with for this whole initiative. At one of our other plants, we've had a situation where they used basically irrigation type pipe as a temporary means to transfer some water. The contractor they used for that work didn't realize that they could create an issue if they use a leaky pipe. So it's all about communications and training and just continuously trying to get it across.
And I assume y'all are working on that, or
yes,
using this as something that lesson learned on what you need to do. Yeah.
Every one of these are operating experiences reports that go and for training.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, that's all I had about Oconee. Any other questions about that event? Okay, general overview. When we started the Groundwater Protection Initiative, we had a few wells around the plant. Some of those were old wells that were there from construction. Not many were really usable as a groundwater monitoring well. We had to install wells that were screened at various depths so we could really get a good idea of what movement of the water movement was like. So at Catawba, we have about 40 wells. We tried to place those around some of the most important structures around the plant, like our spent fuel pool, so if we had a leak, we could detect those. And then but in the normal flow path down gradient that we could detect anything that may have leaked before it gets outside of our plant boundary. So these are our monitoring wells there. Last year at Catawba, we did make two communications. One had to do with a buried piping. It's a fiberglass pipe that had a leak in it. It revealed itself, a water bubble mouth on the surface. Took quite a while to repair that because it was about 30 feet deep. They would do that, and they replaced that line with polyethylene piping. The activity in that leak was fairly low. It was more than Oconee's. I think it was around 7,000 picocuries per liter. So that too was water from the secondary side of the plant. And those are the type pipes that we really have concerns with, and we want the piping initiative to address for us. Are those pipes that were originally not considered to be real sensitive from a radioactive standpoint because they're carrying secondary side water, unlike the primary systems, they're made of stainless and they're put into concrete lined trenches to prevent leaks or prevent spills if you do have a leak. The other one at Catawba, we basically overflowed a pond. We were taking the water out of condenser. We were going to do an inspection on condenser, and one of the valves in the condenser was leaking by. We pumped more water than we expected, and it was not detected that the pond was full, so we had an overflow there. So we went ahead and made a communication for that one. And at Robinson, we got about 30 wells down there. That's the site of a retired fossil plant. So there were some wells associated with that plant as well as with Robinson. And we have been fortunate there. That plant is it's an older plant, but the way it's designed, the risk is fairly low with some of the piping systems and tanks the way they're installed. So we've not had any communications there since the program began. And then Oconee, we have lots of monitoring wells at Oconee. Some of that was associated with those ponds that I mentioned before that were there prior to the groundwater initiative, and we added about 40 more for the program. That's a fairly large site. We had no communications events in 2013 for Oconee. Any question about those plants? So finally,
was there a question?
Yeah, I do have a question.
Yes.
Traditional radiation badging systems are not going to be sensitive to the tritium.
That's correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
So there's really no way of monitoring the effect other than trying to reduce the possible exposures, especially through drinking water.
We have several programs. Of course, you know, if it's in the drinking water, we want to prevent it from being there to start with. But in our programs, we look for tritium in the atmosphere because you could absorb it through the skin or breathe it. And we also, if a person is submerged in water with tritium, so we can do urinalysis programs where if a worker gets to a point and our trigger points and our procedures say we collect urine samples and then analyze that for tritium so we could calculate doses for a worker that may be exposed. Fortunately, that's not something we have to deal with very often. Our plants and our programs are designed not to have tritium exposures for the workers. But the dosimeter would be a urinalysis program.
And what would trigger the urinalysis program?
We do air sampling in our, and the place that would be the most susceptible would be in the spent fuel pool areas where you may have a lot of evaporation for the spent fuel pool and workers in there working. So we do pool air samples and analyze those for tritium. If we get above a certain concentration in those samples, then we would start doing stay time calculations, and a person that exceeds some time in that area would have to do your analysis and submit samples.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir. Background is approximately, what, two orders of magnitude, less than 20,000 picocuries per liter?
I think that's right. We typically see in environmental samples at our environmental lab that can count very low activities, 200, 250 picocuries per liter.
So your 3,000 detection limit is in between them.
That's right.
And I think what Larry, we have some really good equipment at the environmental labs, and so right. They have a lower detection limit. But the stuff on site has a detection limit that's higher.
But I'm trying to think of how long you have to count because, background's around, what is it, 1 part in 10 to the 17th. And so that's, it's still very, very low concentration. At the environmental lab, but on the individual sites here, 3,000. So I'm just trying to figure out that this is a hard thing to measure.
That's right. The site procedures, I believe, they for tritium, they're doing is fairly short counts, like 10-minute count. They do about some evaporation, because you've got to get all the impurities out of water to be able to do the counting. Our environmental lab accounts may be up to 10 or 12 hours to get real low counts on it.
Thank you.
We do special distillations, some other treatment for those samples for the environmental program. This summary really just tells you what I've already said. Tritium is naturally occurring in the environment. Well, we do generate it, and we have the potential to introduce it into the environment programs. that we've instituted is are designed to keep that from happening. It's sometimes very difficult when you're dealing with a large industrial plant. Just talked about the three plants in South Carolina and the event at Oconee specifically.
Questions? I just have one final question. The NEI Groundwater Protection Program was initiated because of radionuclide contamination, but did the plants extend it to diesel fuel and solvents and that kind of stuff?
Yes.
Anything you found in your monitoring well you would take care of?
Under the NEI 0707 initiative, only radioactive materials.
Oh, okay.
Right. The underground piping tank initiative addresses diesel fuel and other solvents.
Okay.
But the reporting criteria of that are really based on the state requirements for reporting those that's already in existence.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you all very much. Thank you
You're
for
welcome.
Bearing with our kind of cranky system today.
Once again, thanks for the chance to come talk to the advisory council. And if you come up with any questions that you think about later, please get a hold of me or Larry, and we'll be glad to do what we can to answer.
Thank you very much. Shelley, I know you're behind that post.
You can't hide forever, huh?
This thing is there we go. Yeah, that's what I was going to do. But okay. Yeah.
Thank you all. We appreciate the very thorough presentation. Thank you.
Well, thank you for setting it up. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the council, everyone here. It's great to be here, and thank you so much for always providing the time for a DHEC update. And today I'll tell you where we are on the high-level waste and the high-level waste tanks. It's as I always say, it's a huge area of focus for DHEC because the 37 million gallons of high-level waste in the tanks, there is hazardous waste, it's radioactive waste, it's a high risk in tanks that are getting older and they're degrading, and some of them are actually in the groundwater table and some of them have leak sites. So it's very, very important for the citizens and the environment that the waste be treated, so that the risk is reduced and also that those tanks be closed. We have a whole host of milestones, into the future to require that risk reduction by certain dates. And again, it's a very high focus area. So I'll just give you a status on where we are. Like I said, it's a huge area where we put a lot of energy and effort. You'll see in some other states, there might be some where people aren't all on the same page in terms of how to move forward. In South Carolina, we have worked hard to make sure that we are all on the same page technically and regulatorily in moving forward with closure of the high-level waste tanks. We've put together closure plans with DOE that have had public comment, and those closure plans have the dates in them for the milestones and the closure. Again, there are no technical or regulatory there are no technical or regulatory hurdles. We have ironed out a path forward to move clearly in the future with the waste treatment and the tank closure. So in light of that fact, we were hoping for smooth sailing. We have closed, DOE has closed six tanks already. We were elated at that success, and again, thought everything was smooth moving towards the future. Around this time last year, I think I began telling you that we noticed a substantial drop in the DOE request for funding for SRS high-level waste. In FY14, that drop was over $100 million, and it represented the largest reduction in DOE funding for the EM, the Environmental Management Fund, for any of their sites in the nation. And so we were very concerned that there was such a huge drop in that funding last year. In the face of such a successful program, we were concerned that that amount of money would not sufficiently fuel the program forward to be able to meet the milestones on the schedule. So that's where we were last year. Today I'll give you kind of part two or an update on that story. I wanted to mention two of the tanks that are next on the horizon, tanks 12 and tank 16. Those tanks are supposed to be closed at the end of September for 2015. And we're already working on that closure. We have reviewed some early draft portions of the tank 16 closure module. And we've already been briefed on the tank 12 sampling and characterization plans. And so again, it's DHEC's intent that the regulatory review will not in any way delay a closure event. So we, like I said, we have been very efficient in the past. We have optimized our regulatory reviews, and we intend to be very timely so that we don't incur any extra time in the schedule. So we're already working on those now. Of course, tanks 12 and 16, the closure module, will have a public comment period and public input. So, but getting back to that lack of funding, on May 29th, DHEC got a briefing from Department of Energy on the Rev 19 Liquid Waste System Plan. Well, you may think that's another regulatory or technical kind of document, and it is. But the important thing is that this plan crystallizes the budget impact. And so the plan factors in the low amount for FY14 and also the projected amounts of funding from FY15 moving forward. So it incorporates those spending levels and models the progress into the future. And here's the bottom line. That Rev 19 system plan projects to miss every single liquid waste milestone commitment to the state in the future. Now that's very significant. And when I say every single liquid waste milestone, that's 12 milestones for bulk waste removal of the tanks. It's 18 tank closure milestones. It's one milestone for startup of the big treatment facility, the salt waste processing facility, and also the end date by which all of that high-level waste has to be treated, which is 2028. So yes, we were correct that the funding drop is affecting and derailing the future of the liquid waste program in terms of milestones and commitments to the state. So we were very, very disappointed to see that crystallized in the projections. Now, of course, can that change? Certainly. If DOE asks for the money and they get sufficient funding, that could change. And we're urging DOE continually to ask for enough money and really fight for enough money so that the milestones and then the commitments to the state can be fulfilled. So the other thing I'd like to note is that for each of those milestones that I mentioned, if you look at the cumulative years of delay projected by that system plan, it's over 200 years of cumulative delay for the milestones if you add them all up. And again, that's a staggering number of years by anybody's account. So we were again very concerned about the projections for the future. And our director, Templeton, wrote a letter on June 16th to Secretary Moniz, capturing that concern and stating that we believe it's DOE's obligation to fight for the money, to meet commitments, that we will not agree to milestone extensions sought because DOE decided that not enough money should come to Savannah Riverside to meet those commitments. So that's where we stand currently, and our hope is that DOE will again fight for that money to honor commitments to South Carolina. Any questions?
Questions? Are you expecting a response from DOE?
Well, we'd certainly like to have one, yes. I've not gotten one yet.
I don't know that there's anything that the council can do, but if you do you know anything we can do to push this funding issue? And if you think of something, let us know.
Well, I certainly appreciate your actions in the past. And if you could, along with us, just urge DOE to request and fight for the money.
We'll do. Questions?
Yeah. Is this just primarily just $100 million causing all this problem, or is there some other reason?
I don't know why DOE did not request the money.
No, so is that?
It's more than $100 million, but frankly, I don't know what's at the root of it. But the big treatment facility delay, SWPF, that plays partly into it, but it certainly does not account for over 200 cumulative years.
Right.
The money is a big, huge piece as well.
And let me just say that Pete Hill's going to do a presentation on the Rev 19 system plan, so that might help us understand what the issues are.
Shelley, if DOE does not meet the milestones in which has been set up or the promises to us, will they at that time be fined? If so, where will the money for the fines come from?
That's a very good question, but yes, we do anticipate assessing fines and penalties. There are some stipulated penalties and already in place, and I think in our letter we noted that at the end of FY15 those fines could amount to more than $193 million. So they're significant penalties, and they would come from Department of Energy. So the Federal Facility Compliance Act specifically waived any immunity that the federal government would have for for these kinds of fines and penalties, just like any other industry would pay. So so they would come from our tax dollars, unfortunately. So we're not in it for the money. We're in it to get DOE's attention, hoping that they'll request the money to do the work so they don't have to pay the penalties.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth or even make DHEC say something they don't want to say, but your goal is not necessarily to fine them. It is to make them toe the line and get that waste moving.
That's what we would like, but we're certainly prepared to fine.
Thanks. Other questions?
I do have one question on particularly Tank 16. The cost there for that closure should be essentially minimal. I don't think there's been anything in that tank since the mid-70s. So I was wondering, is the reason for going after that tank and closing it because there's a lack of funds? Or why hasn't it been closed before, or what?
Well, it's other tanks have been closed. That one's just next on the agenda, and DOE can tell you a lot more about how much it costs. But all that grout costs a good bit of money, and characterizing the residual. So, but you're right. It's not a matter of cost from emptying the tank. It's a matter of the cost to characterize the residuals and put the grout in and do the rest of the closure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Shelley. Appreciate it. It is now time for our break, so we'll say 10 minutes. And let me just tell you, we're waiting for Senator Young to get here because he wants to hear the German presentation. So if he's not here, I might ask you to switch your schedule a little bit. Okay, 10 minutes. Look at your watches back here. Thank you all.
Girls in the National Lab. And Maxine Maxted was supposed to be here. She is our spent fuel program manager at the Savannah River site. Unfortunately, she has a family emergency she needs to tend to today. And so I want to introduce Gary DeLeon. He's from headquarters. He's the director of nuclear material disposition. And he's going to talk about the potential program for accepting German spent nuclear fuel that was of U.S. origin. And So I appreciate Gary sitting in for Maxine on very short notice, but Gary's very familiar with this program and has been involved with it from its onset. So Gary, welcome.
Okay, thanks.
And welcome, thank you.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide you an update on as Pat has stressed that this is a potential project. I mean, let me just stress the point that the Department of Energy has not made a decision on whether or not we would accept this bill, but